The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for the Dharma talk today, I want to pick up on another piece of violence that happened yesterday that has some impact on Buddhists, and that is probably the most sacred spot for Buddhists in the world is the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya in India. It's a site where the Buddha was enlightened. And the most holiest place on this temple grounds is the Bodhi tree, which is a descendant of the tree under which the Buddha attained his awakening. What's said is that cuttings from the tree were taken to Sri Lanka, and then some hundreds of years later, someone took cuttings from that tree and replanted it in the place where the original tree stood. So this tree is considered the most sacred, you know, so it's kind of like the Mecca or Jerusalem or something for Buddhists. And so Sunday morning, there was 9 bombs were exploded in Bodh Gaya and Mahabodhi Temple, a terrorist attack there. And they were kind of low-impact bombs or low-intensity bombs, but 2 monks were injured, and not a lot of damage was done. And people are speculating why it might have happened. One idea is that it's retaliation for what's happening in Burma, where some of the Buddhists and Buddhist monks even are involved in violence against the Muslims. And there's other theories. No one has taken any responsibility for it. So what do we do as good Buddhists? Take up arms, get angry, be upset? What's our role? Our most sacred site. So that's what I'd like to talk about today. And I read somewhere in the paper today that Dalai Lama expressed his sadness about the event. It seems like he was mostly talking about the sadness about these monks who were injured, but he talked about the sadness. It's a sad event to have this happen. There are traditionally considered to be 4 pilgrimage sites that Buddhists will go to, 4 holy sites. There's a place where Buddha was enlightened, where he was born, where he was enlightened, where he first taught, and where he died. And from the most ancient texts, there were, attributed to the Buddha, there were instructions for people to go visit these 4 places. And there's important places to go. So I'd like to read a story about this kind of pilgrimage. This is from my book called A Monastery Within, Tales from the Buddhist Path. At the beginning of every year, the abbess would meet with the new monks and nuns who had joined the monastery the preceding year. "Pack your bags," she would say. "I'm taking you on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of Buddhism." Knowing of the pilgrimages to the places in India where the Buddha was born, enlightened, first taught, and died, the new monastics couldn't believe their good fortune, especially because after the first few months in the monastery, some of the new residents were bored, some were restless, and some were unsure why they were there. On the day of the departure, all the older monks and nuns in the monastery stood by the gate to send off the abbess and the new monastics. Leading the group, the abbess first took them to a hospital. There they visited the sick. Then the abbess took the group to an old age home. The new monastics, many who were quite young, were amazed at the ravages of old age. The abbess then took them to a hospice. In the hours there, they spent time with people in all stages of dying. The last few hours were spent in silent vigil with someone who had just died. The abbess then led the group back to the monastery. There they visited a nun sick in the infirmary. The new monastics were struck by the sparkle of joy which radiated through the tired eyes of the patient. Then they went to visit the oldest resident of the monastery, a 96-year-old monk. The group was awed by the love and acceptance that shone forth from the toothless, frail, and stooped man. Next, the abbess took them to the hospice wing of the monastery. Here they were introduced to a nun who, only days away from her death, radiated a palpable peace that lingered within them for hours after. Finally, the abbess took the monastics to the meditation hall. When they were seated, she said, "You have seen the holy sites. These are the sites that motivated the Buddha to awaken. Once you are awakened, you will no longer be troubled when you encounter old age, sickness, and death." So the story reframes or redefines what the holy sites of Buddhism are. Rather than being the locations in India, it has to do with the encounter we have, our relationship we have with sickness, old age, and death. And these we can encounter, you know, we don't have to go to India to encounter these. They're part and parcel of our life. And it has to do with how we relate to it. And how we relate to the experience of our life is the essence of Buddhist practice. Buddhist practice is not found in India. It's not found in Bodh Gaya. It's not found at the Mahabodhi Temple. The Bodhi tree and the Mahabodhi Temple, they're just kind of like nice reminders of what's important. And what's important is for us to be able to find our own awakening, to change the way that we relate to our world so that we ourselves can live in this world in a peaceful way, in an awakened way. So if you, you know, you see me holding the striker here, and this striker might be, I might think this is a very important striker. And I'm very attached to it because if I hit the striker against the bell just right, it's just the right striker to make the perfect sound. It'll make you think that I'm a perfect bell ringer. And so I have to, you know, this is really important. So I'm not going to let anybody take it. So I'm going to hold it really tight and keep it here to myself. No one's going to, because it's so important. And I can be so focused on the striker because it's so important, right? That's one way I could relate to it. The other way I can relate to this whole event is I can focus on what it's like to be grasping the striker. And if I look at that part of the, if I look at the important striker, then I'm blinded to the pain of my knuckles getting white and sore, holding tight to this, you know, there. But if I feel my hand grasping tight, pretty soon this hurts. I don't know if I want to do this anymore. This is tiring. The whole relationship to this changes if I switch from the striker to how I'm relating to the striker, how I hold the striker. So in that way, Buddhism asks us to switch our attention from the things, some of the things which are very important in our life, not to dismiss them or diminish their value, but to turn from what they are or towards how we are in relationship to them. How do we hold them? How do we relate to them? Do we resist them? Do we cling to them? Do we hate them? Do we love them? What's our role? What do we do there? And so that's what's important. That's where freedom is found. That's where the practice is found. So in terms of people who want to attack Buddhism, the opening discourse, you know, there's no real beginning of the Buddhist Bible like there is for the Judeo-Christian Bibles. But there's one way of looking at the beginning would be the first discourse in the first collection, and then you look at the very beginning of it. Well, you know, if you had to kind of start at the beginning, that's where you would start. But it's not the, you know, so. And in that text, you know, on the English page 2, it begins with a story. The story is the Buddha is traveling around India with a group of monks. And some other wandering ascetic has somehow joined their wandering. But the other ascetic and his partner are constantly disparaging the Buddha for days. He's going along and criticizing him. And so one evening, the Buddha kind of addresses this issue. And he says, "Monks, if anyone should speak in disparagement of me, of the Dharma, or the Sangha, you should not be angry, resentful, or upset on that account. If you were to be angry or displeased at such disparagement, that would only be a hindrance to you. For if others disparage me, the Dharma, or the Sangha, and you are angry and displeased, can you recognize whether what they say is right or not? No, they say. If others disparage me, the Dharma or the Sangha, then you must explain what is incorrect as being incorrect, saying, that is incorrect, that is false, that is not our way. That is not found among us. But, monks, if others should speak in praise of me, of the Dharma or the Sangha, you should not, on account of that, be pleased, happy, or elated. If you were to be pleased, happy, or elated at such praise, that would only be a hindrance to you. If others praise me, the Dharma, or the Sangha, you should acknowledge the truth of what is true, saying, that is correct, that is right, that is our way, that is found among us. So it's kind of, I kind of love it that, you know, one way of looking at the opening of the Buddhist discourses, the whole teaching, is don't be concerned about getting upset, or don't get upset, or don't get happy if someone disparages or praises your religion. You know, just listen to it, and if it seems true, you can acknowledge what's true. If it's not true, you can try to have a conversation and say, that's not how it is here. But you wouldn't be upset. And the reason for it that he gives is that if you get upset or if you get elated, you won't be able to see clearly. You won't be able to understand clearly. And so here again, we see the emphasis comes back to ourselves, to our ability to relate and how we relate. Can we relate with clarity? Can we relate with understanding that is not colored by our likes and dislikes, by our upsets and our you know, elation? So mindfulness practice is supposed to be a great support for this. Mindfulness practice has its genesis in ourselves and our ability to sit still, be quiet enough, to be able to tune in to our part of the equation and how we're holding the striker, how we're relating to the world. If we're blinded by the world, the things in the world we want, by the people around us, by jobs and money and all that, then we don't find the Dharma. The Dharma is found not by rejecting any of it, but it's found how we relate to it. And it's a very hard lesson for people to learn, to turn their attention away from wanting to fix the world, wanting things to be a certain way, towards the freedom that can be found when we look at the how we relate to it, what the relationship is. You know, one of the things that can happen in meditation, or something like meditation, where you sit quietly long enough and stay in touch with yourself and see what's going on, how your hand is grasping. Some of the things that we're constantly doing don't seem so tenable anymore. It's possible, you know, perhaps to spend all day thinking about your bank account. And you're concerned about your bank account, this and that, and kind of, you know, just, and then you sit down to meditate and you're still thinking about your bank account, but now there's this heightened awareness that you're doing it. And you feel, this is too much. This is a drag. I'm caught. I am enslaved to these thoughts. You know, I am, you know, this is tiring. It's causing headache. This is not where freedom is. In daily life, when life is busy, it's easy to kind of just follow along in the streams of our thinking. But it's hard sometimes to follow those streams and perpetuate it when you take time to stop. Maybe close your eyes and just be. Just be with yourself and feel. And maybe the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes of meditation, you're still happily going along. But if you meditate long enough, at some point, you say, wait a minute. This is not what I want to be doing. There's more to life than, you know, what I'm always thinking about and doing. And so when you sit quiet for a while, it kind of can naturally begin shifting the relationship to something that's more primary, more intimate, closer in. And so we can start finding where the true refuge is, where the true temple is, where the true holy site is, which has to be in ourselves. In our Buddhist tradition, we have the Theravada tradition, when people take refuge in the Buddha, it's a very important religious step that people take, taking refuge in the Buddha, it's explicitly said that we people are not taking refuge in the Buddha as a person, but rather taking refuge in the Buddha's awakening. The fact that there is awakening is an example of someone who's freed their mind, found a mind which is deeply at peace. We take refuge, we're inspired by the fact that this is possible. Not because we're just then going to put the Buddha up on a pedestal, but rather the Buddha represents something that we can do for ourselves. We say that when we bow to the Buddha in our tradition, we're really bowing to ourselves, because the Buddha just represents a capacity we all have. And so the idea is to discover that capacity. So in the Dhammapada it says, people threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees, this important word, sees, who's the one who sees? So the idea is that it's something you do. You learn to see. It's not like reading a book and learning teachings, but the idea is to develop the capacity to see clearly something yourself. When someone sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the ending of suffering, then this is the secure refuge, this is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So the Four Noble Truths are a way of just talking about changing the way we hold on to the striker. We don't cling to it. We see that that clinging to the striker hurts, suffering. We see that the clinging is what causes the suffering, and we know we can stop the clinging. And I can hold the striker very lightly. I don't have to cling to it at all. Just very light and make a nice sound. Isn't that nice? And the result of that is that then the mind, the heart, can be at peace. The heart can be open, available to the world, to respond to the world in a very different way than when the heart is closed or tight. And one of the hopes I have of this Dharma practice we have is we become people who are able to meet and respond to the world with open, ringing hearts, rather than with, you know, tightly clenched strikers. And in terms of religion and religious violence and religious, you know, conflict, someone came to the Buddha to debate him, to critical of him, and the Buddha just wasn't going to debate, wasn't going to get involved in it. And so the Buddha said, told this man, what opponent would you get from those who live without opponents, who don't counter views with views, who don't grasp anything here as ultimate? Isn't that something? So what's interesting about this early Buddhist teachings is that over and over again they also stress, don't hold on to anything as being the ultimate religious teaching. Don't grasp at that. Because the teachings are not what the point is. The point is the non-grasping. And even if you grasp the teaching of non-grasping, you're in trouble. You've missed the boat. Then you're holding on to the striker. So there's no arguing with people in your non-clinging. I mean, the non-clinging, what are you to argue about? So if the essence of this teaching, this ancient tradition, is not a teaching, but rather an experience. The essence is not a doctrine, but rather a release. The essence is not really an understanding, though understanding is part of it, but rather is this freedom that's possible. So if someone bombs our holiest sites, I think it's just a wonderful opportunity for us to be free. That's what we want to manifest in the world. Is not, if we manifest anger, despair, I don't think we're doing the Buddha's work. We don't want to kind of just pretend it's all okay and just go along as if that's okay, you know. But you know, to hold it lightly, to not be troubled by it, to use it as a encouragement to come back to ourselves and find our freedom. The holiest side of Buddhism, the Mahabodhi Temple, is there, again, it's pointing to the possibility for each of us to be free. That's what it's there for. And people can't take that away from us with a bomb. So generally in Buddhism, when people, it happened a few times now over the last decade or so, that people have destroyed Buddhist statues and temples in different parts of the world. Generally Buddhists don't go up in arms around that. They'd rather they didn't do it. It's kind of sad to lose the heritage. But there's something much more important going on here. Maybe we don't need any temples in the end. We just need to have open hearts. So do you have any comments or questions about that? Want to take exceptions to any of it?
Gil, Do you know if any Buddhists are speaking out regarding the violence that's been happening in Burma, where Buddhists have been attacking Muslims and saying, rethink this. This isn't helpful.
I haven't been following the news so closely around this, but I have read accounts of Buddhists who have been protesting this, writing letters. In Burma, the people who have been upset. In Burma, there have been Buddhists who have been critical of it and try to oppose it, and there have been here in California there have been Buddhist leaders who have been writing letters and they try and make a difference. I don't know what some of the international leaders like Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, I don't know what they've done. It's a difficult situation.
Thank you. Thank you for the talk.
You know, as tragic as it is that what's happening in Burma, and I don't want to in any way kind of say it's a good thing, but exactly. But occasionally, Buddhists have kind of thought of themselves as a little bit holier than everybody else. You know, like, we don't do religious wars. We don't do those things. We don't have terrorists. So now we can't say that. So now we can be a little more less holy. Yes?
As a comment, in Sri Lanka there has been a lot of violence.
Also, in Sri Lanka there's been a lot of violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Sri Lanka is another country where there's been a lot of violence. If you don't have to go very far in Buddhist Asia to find a variety of different kinds of violence that Buddhists have been involved in, Buddhist monks have been involved in. I think generally the stories are not as dramatic. I think when people say sometimes people have said there's been no war in the name of Buddhism. Generally, I think what they're trying to say is that there's no one has tried to impose Buddhism on other people. But there have been occasionally, or protecting Buddhism per se. It's more Buddhists, Buddhist ethnic people are attacking Hindu ethnic people. And so the Buddhists are involved in it, but it's not necessarily so much a religious war. If you go down through the history of it in Asia, there's been example of soldier monks who've gone to battle and fought in a variety of different countries. And so you find the full range, even in modern Asia, like there's just like there would be in anywhere in the world, there are liberal, progressive, nonviolent people, Buddhists, and then there are, conservative or right-wing people who are interested in violence. And so you find the full range. And so you have to be very careful when you talk about Buddhism to appreciate that there's a wide range of Buddhist teachings, just like there's a wide range of teachings in other religions and different orientations. Even the Dalai Lama has been involved in, I don't think he's been involved in violence, but in Dharamsala, the different orders of monks have been at each other with knives. You know, they're not sitting there peacefully, only peacefully meditating, but, you know, there's a very intense inter-religious rivalry even within Buddhist groups. It's a small percentage of what goes on, but it's there. And I would argue that it's a misunderstanding of this early teaching. And I think that my reading, understanding the early teaching, is that if we understand it well, there would be no Buddhists would not be involved in perpetuating violence, would not be responding, wouldn't be defending their religion this way. There's nothing to defend. I don't think Buddhism is anything to defend. Because as soon as you defend it, you've destroyed it yourself. Because it's in you, right? It's how you hold. If you hold the sword, you've destroyed it. If you hold the flower to offer someone, then you have created it. Yes?
Is it on?
If you hold it horizontally.
Talk to the top. Okay. I'm of the Marshall. Does exist in the world outside of Buddhism.
Yes.
And if the Buddhists are one with the universe, then they're also one with that. So it's really a matter of trying to make it appropriate.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't think the idea of being one with the universe is generally not a Buddhist idea, that we're supposed to be one with the universe, because that's putting... So it was a very interesting phenomenon, but in religion in the West, when Buddhism comes to the West, is that Western religion is so focused on a relationship to something external, like a relationship to God, and it's very hard. And so the whole understanding of religion is one about relatedness. And so the idea of oneness with the world, the universe, again has to do with the relationship with the world as being the point. And Buddhism is not about what we relate to, but how we're relating to anything at all. And so rather than relating to a god or relating to heaven, the focus in Buddhism, in a sense, is more how do we relate to ourselves? What's happening with us? So there's no goal to be one with the universe, one with things. The goal is to not cling to anything and not to perpetuate violence towards anything.
No. I've found by not clinging to anything, I still exist in the physical form with muscles and the ability to use them.
Yes.
I run into tasks which require force. There are conditions of pests like rodents and fleas and diseases and things where the world I see is better off if you get rid of the vectors of disease and things. And it does involve destroying something. You know what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. I'm not necessarily going along with you.
Okay, then what would you do with a rat with fleas that are killing people because of some plague? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. I don't know what I would do. I like it. What I really like is when people run into the challenge of pests and are thoughtful about it and considerate and don't come with the automatic first answer is I'm going to kill them.
Yeah.
Maybe the other ways. Let's look at this and see what's really necessary. There's a very strong tendency for some people to go to the killing first.
Oh, I understand that. Yeah.
And so what are the other options? And so we've had like when we first moved into our house we live in now, we had this ant problem that was quite something. And it was quite fascinating to try to figure out, you know, what it would take to get to keep the ants. And we had all these elaborate things going on, and eventually we figured out how to keep the ants out without having to spray the house. I've gone to the trouble to use my cupped hands to catch mosquitoes in my house and then take them out, rather than slap them and kill them. So there are alternatives to slapping, right? There are alternatives. I've taken, you know, have a heart traps and taken the mice and the rats and captured them and taken them out in the woods. So there are alternatives. There are things that can be done. Whether the alternatives are the always going to work, the nonviolent alternatives, and some, is there sometimes appropriate to commit violence towards and kill some being? I'd rather not be involved in deciding for anybody, myself. Let them decide, find their own way with that. But I want to really champion and encourage people to take their time with that and look at the alternatives. And the alternatives, you know, also the alternatives, also some of the means we use to eradicate pests have secondary effects. And so, we think we're wise finally after 40, 50, 100 years of these. But it used to be DDT, right? Just go in there, just... and that sure worked. But then there were these secondary effects that were not so good. And so what are the secondary effects? In the Bay Area, we have so much use of herbicides and pesticides that, you know, it's phenomenal the amount that people use. And what ends up in the runoff water, ends up in the bay, causes damage in the bay and problems there. How are we living with the secondary effects? It's very easy when it's the whole idea of me, myself, and mine. I have a problem, I have to fix it, and I'm going to do it violently, and not look at the bigger picture of the causes and consequences of what's really going on. And I apologize a little bit to you because I'm about to change the whole analogy to something different, but if I'll give you an example in my life. You know, it was hard for me to learn to be a parent. I'm still learning. And so we had, my older son was sometimes difficult. And so I did my best, all kinds of ways. And sometimes it just seemed like I had to use what I call my strong voice. He goes, no. You're very strong. And I would very occasionally use a strong voice, and I was impressed. It was effective. And I said, sometimes it's good to do that. Until one day, I heard him use that same tone of voice to his younger brother. And I said, uh-oh, what have I done? And then I thought, well, maybe it was effective in the moment, but to measure it as effective in the moment without looking at the consequences rippled out from it, maybe it was nearsighted. So I think, you know, if we're involved in violence, we have to really look at the situation carefully and all the different parameters of it, all the different things. And from a Buddhist point of view, what Buddhists say, what I'd like to say is rather than looking at the, one of the really important things is to look in your own heart. And if you have a settled, relaxed heart, and you're tuned into your heart, then how do you respond? What motivates you then? Because I know in myself that if I'm harried, upset, angry, late for something, I could say something mean just off the cuff very quickly. I could say, you know, there's a bug in my way, you know, and. I could just be a mean son of a something. But if I'm calm and relaxed and peaceful and have lots of time in the world, then I'm tuned into a different part of myself. And then how I respond to the world is going to be very different. So one of the important things from a Buddhist practice point of view is not to answer your question, should we or shouldn't we use violence, but rather, where do we come from in ourselves when we do it? Are we really settled in a deep way? And if we are settled in a deep way, then what comes from our heart then, not rather than our mind? Does that make some sense?
You just reminded me of what I always tend to arrive at. Is I can't solve that problem because it, I mean, completely. But as you say, it's a practice to make yourself maybe closer to it.
Yes.
But I can't conceive of ever, when I'm completely dead, of course.
Yeah. So I think it's hard to conceive. I find it very interesting that I'm not sure you did this today, but I find it interesting that sometimes when we talk about nonviolence, we talk about anger and working with anger in Buddhism, often people want to talk about insist that there are exceptions. And I've wondered sometimes the very powerful drive to point out exceptions. Maybe there are exceptions, but why is a strong need to say it all the time? Why defend it? Do you have any idea why? As opposed to 99% of the time where it's useful to be nonviolent, why defend the 1% of the time it's not? Do you have any idea?
I do.
Oh, yeah.
I have an opinion.
Hold it closer.
I have an opinion.
Yeah, I'd like to hear.
For instance, this country came about through a revolution. It had certain qualities and has certain qualities that could never have been instituted had there not been people who stood up and instituted something which other people were trying to prevent from happening. The result of it has been a place where things have flourished. There have been hospitals built that wouldn't have been built. There have been schools and intelligence and a place where everyone wants to come because it's somewhat of a heaven compared to the rest of the world.
Somewhat, with the highest incarceration rate in the world as well. More prisons.
What was it?
Highest incarceration rate in the world as well.
Yes, prison. But I believe...
There was a very interesting article. I read this a few times now. I guess because it was 4th of July. There was an article by a Canadian who said that probably the United States would have been better off if it hadn't had the revolution. That the independence from England would have happened relatively soon anyway. It didn't have to happen through a revolution, and it would have set a very different set of conditions for this country if it had waited a couple of decades rather than done it violently. And they said, in America, there's a glorification of the revolution, and it can be nothing wrong about the revolution, right? But, maybe there was an alternative, like even back then. And maybe we could have been more like Canada. they have good universities and but less prisons. So anyway, it's interesting. Thank you. I appreciate everything you said, and these are issues which are good to air and explore.
I'll just finish by doing what I always do when I can't solve a problem. I just breathe.
No. Perfect way to end. Thank you. Thank you all.